Welcome to the Home Building Hero, where we help you become the hero of your new home by providing you all the information that you need. No matter if you're an industry pro, you're building, or you're buying, we got you covered here at the Home Building Hero. We're coming to you live today from the LP Studios here in Wisconsin. I'm your host, David Bellman, president of Bellman Homes. Thank you for tuning in today. I am here today with Joe Manassa, a realtor from Joe Manassa Real Estate and a housing influencer from Tallahassee, Florida. Hey, Joe, welcome to the Home Building Hero.
Hey, David. Great to be here. Thanks.
Yep. I appreciate you coming onto the program. I've got to share the reason that I'm having you on here is was looking for some information and I found a video you posted on YouTube and I just loved your approach to using data to dispel some myths on housing. That's something that I try and do as well, because a lot of times there's, data or articles that are posted that don't really have all the facts. So I appreciate your approach. And I was like, man, I got to get you on the podcast here and we got to have a conversation. So thank you again for joining us.
I'm glad to be here.
So why don't you start off by telling us a little bit more about yourself and what you do and maybe a little bit about your YouTube channel as well and your thoughts behind that.
Yeah, I'm a real estate broker now for over 30 years. And in our industry, there's not much analysis done from within. Most people that get into real estate are salespeople. And so you don't get a lot of, a client typically doesn't get a lot of real market information. And what I've done is I've just scoured the internet for all the data on housing I can find. And I try to deliver a data-centric message. I'm not pushing an agenda. I'm just trying. Well, everyone pushes an agenda. My agenda is people will respect the fact that I'm putting out the information, whether it sounds good or not. And I think I'll draw a pretty good clientele from people who want to know what's truly going on. Most of what we hear about housing, we hear about through the normal media and then on social media. And most of it's bunk. It's just garbage. And, you know, some of it's right because, you know, something's got to be right eventually. But I mean, 2 years ago, people calling for foreclosures, I refuted that right away. I said, it cannot happen. There's too much equity in the market. And I was able to produce data from the Fred website that showed how much equity was in housing. And it's like, if everybody's deficient, they'll sell their house and take equity out of it. They don't need to go through a foreclosure sale. So anyway, my background is in the analytical side of real estate. I have a degree in computer science from West Point. I've since gone on to get my master's degree. So I'm kind of a little bit of an education nerd. And what I'm trying to do is deliver a here's what's really happening based on the metrics.
That's awesome. And I appreciate that. We'll dive a little more heavily into that in a moment. But I mean, obviously that approach, I think it just gives you a lot of credibility in the market when you do that, because you're building trust. And I think especially for a real estate agent and home sales, that's really key to do that. And people can disagree with your point, but when you have facts, it's really hard to disagree with the facts. Right. So I love that approach. That's what I try and do as well. And so, you know, like I said, I think, you know, we have a similar approach to that. So just want to jump back one step and just kind of what got you interested in real estate? Because obviously you have that computer science background and you said you're an education buff. So what about real estate really appealed to you?
Well, in the Army, I was Airborne Ranger Infantry. Okay.
First of all, thank you so much for your service and welcome home.
Thank you. Basically, the Army Ranger is the brute force and ignorance type, can go further, carry more and blow up more stuff than anybody out there. And I just think that kind of is my persona. And I like to take on challenges. And when I was getting out of the military, I started going on a lot of these job interviews with, we'll say, quote unquote, normal jobs, you know, corporate America. And infomercials late at night, we're talking about buying real estate and how to make money owning real estate. And I got so fascinated with that, I ended up getting back to my hometown and getting into real estate. And I've since bought almost 1,000 properties. I mean, I've definitely embraced the whole entrepreneurial side of real estate.
And how many years have you been in real estate now?
31.
31.
Got in 1991.
So yeah, you've seen a lot of different markets in that time.
Yes.
Absolutely. So kind of the topic and the reason why I wanted to bring you on is really to talk about some of the challenges, especially with the narratives and housing that are coming out. And you kind of alluded to one story already, about foreclosures during COVID, which, you know, you debunked and obviously were correct on. So why do you think that there are these kind of wrong narratives? Is it because of the newspapers, just trying to sell links and people on it, or is it they're just ignorant, or what do you think that is?
Well, I think it's a combination of both things. I think the newspaper management says, hey, housing's becoming a hot topic. Let's put some of our reporters on it. These reporters have zero background in economics. They have zero background in anything mathematically related. They're all journalists. So they do their best to research the topic, but when they go to research their topic, they're really just cheating. They're going out on the internet and seeing what everybody's saying. So you basically have herd mentality, and they're reporting it, and that makes it true because it's on all the headlines of all the major publications. And the reality is nobody is analyzing the simple supply and demand dynamic. And I hate to throw away all the work I've done to say, hey, it's actually easier than this. All you have to do is pay attention to supply and demand, and you know where prices will go. You know, I can sound a whole lot smarter by quoting all these other statistics, but just look at supply and demand and you know where home prices are headed.
Yeah, no, I agree with that. Yeah, I agree with that completely. And that's, again, something that I try and do as well. And, you know, the bottom line is the rules of supply and demand always seem to kind of trump anything else that's out there.
Right.
And, if it doesn't smell right or, you know, feel right, and you start to then cross-check it with the supply and demand and say, hey, look, there's no homes out there and they're still selling and the price is going up, that means there's demand. Maybe there's just not enough inventory out there. So a lot of times you can find the answers to the questions, and we are in a very data-centric industry, right? I mean, you have your MLSs and you have all these websites that are reporting information. So the information's out there. It's just a matter of taking the time to pull it together and then
right,
put some thought behind it. So obviously when you see a headline that maybe is questionable or it doesn't seem to it's past the sniff test, let's say, how do you dispel or counter it?
Well, I'm constantly looking for the reason that I'm wrong, because I'm basically a contrarian. Everybody in the country is calling for crashing housing market, and I just don't see the data that supports that conclusion. But I also know that I'm not a genius. So I'm looking for, why am I wrong? And so anytime I see one of these crazy headlines, I look into it and I look at the data that should support it, because almost none of these articles are supported by data. They're supported by opinion. You know, we did a survey of realtors and they said home prices are going to come down. Well, realtors don't measure anything. Okay? Realtors are a magical industry that is able to do so much good work and move so many numbers around, but they don't measure anything. And that's been the case for the 31 years I've been in the business.
Yeah. And you know? I think, so, you know, you're right on the herd mentality as well, because I think sometimes, like, if they were an agent works for a bigger company, they might be getting their information from the top down. And the other thing that's challenging with a headline is that could be true in a particular market, but it may not be true in the rest of the country. And,
right.
And a lot of times these bigger publications, you know, they take a bigger market like Florida, where you are in, and they try and apply that to the whole country. And we're all very different at different times. And so I don't think they get the local perspective. Would you agree with that?
Amen. Cause you know, we are clearly in a undersupplied market nationally, but I know there's a handful of markets out there that have way too many homes. So sure. If you're taking the national message and trying to apply it locally, you could be in harm's way.
So you've kind of did something similar to what I did. So recently I kind of debunked an article from the Wall Street Journal about lumber prices being pre-pandemic levels. And I'm like, no, that's not true. The futures are pre-pandemic, but not the prices. So I kind of debunked that. I put it on LinkedIn. I think it's got like 50,000 views now. So it's been it's good that people are seeing that. And I've been getting a lot of thank yous for correcting that information. But you recently came across a Forbes article that said the housing bubble will be the second worst since the Great Depression. Share your thoughts on that, because I know you mentioned that when we first talked, and I'd love to hear what you think about that.
First of all, I love the headline because it got my attention. Whoa, worst price decline since the second worst price decline since the Great Depression. Oh my goodness, that's terrible. And then I went and looked at it and I said, well, wait a minute, what they're really saying, because we know the worst price correction came after the housing bubble. There's only been two times that prices fell since the Great Depression. Okay, in the last 80 years, they've fallen after World War II, or at the beginning of World War II, and then after the Great Recession. Other than that, home prices have risen. I mean, there's been 35, 38, 40-year streaks of rising home prices every year. That's the norm. Falling prices is the exception. And so their headline really grabbed me. Whoa, second worst home price decline. What their headline really said was home prices are not going to decline like they did after the housing bubble. That's what their headline really says. And I agree with that. And it's just so funny because that's not what it said, but that's what it says.
Well, there's the old adage, right? In the media, if it bleeds, it reads, right?
Amen.
So do you think that's really what it was, that they just were trying to draw, maybe click people in? Or do you think there was, another motive behind that?
I think it's the ignorance of the reporter. I mean, wow, second biggest decline since the Great Depression. And you go, well, there's only been two declines since the Great Depression, so it had to be first, second, or third, it had to be one of those.
I'll give them credit, right? That was creative writing to put it that way, right?
Yes, it, beautiful headline.
Absolutely. They get A plus for the headline. And I think that's the same as kind of what I was dealing with, is the headline was kind of interesting because it's like, oh, it caught people's eye, but it's like, no, it doesn't. Yeah. When you dig into the actual words, they could have still had a very powerful headline had they just changed the one word, and then it would have been accurate. But
right,
I guess that is what it is. Maybe that was the point of it. But so obviously consumers then get confused because of this, and they get scared and that type of thing. So what advice do you have to consumers that are out there shopping for homes and they face this kind of confusion?
Well, first of all, take in the information, but respect the fact that real estate is local. It doesn't matter that there's not enough homes in the U.S. if you live in Las Vegas. Right now, there's too many homes in Las Vegas. Okay, so you really have to know what your local market is really doing. And I can tell you that most real estate agents are reactionary. So they're really not going to be able to set up a supply and demand curve for you. So I'd say select the agent. In these times, your agent selection counts more than ever because you've got to have somebody you can trust. And right now, the information I'm hearing from a lot of people is just broken.
Yep. Yeah. And I think one of the other kind of misconceptions is that, okay, we know rates are up and that's obviously a shock. They went up very quickly. So that definitely changes the financial dynamic for buyers. But the one positive that we're not hearing about is the equity that a lot of these current homeowners are gaining and have gained over the past couple of years. And I think that offsets a lot of that interest rate increase, because especially if they're selling something that's in that lower tier of pricing, they're going to have a lot of equity, and those homes are still selling pretty quickly and for a lot of times over asking.
Yeah, but there's a bigger problem. And like one of my main messages is this is not 2006. In 2006, there were 4 million homes on the market in the U.S. Today, there's 1 million homes on the market. There is not enough supply. That means there's no fuel to crash home prices. Doesn't mean there's not shock in the market where you might see some fluctuations down, but it can't be sustained because there's not enough housing units. Okay, but when we go and we look at what most people are thinking and talking about, they're all trapped behind what I refer to as recency bias. Nobody remembers the 1960s. If early in 1960 you said, what, $14,000 for a home? This is crazy. I'm going to wait. Okay. You would have had to wait till 2006 okay, 46 years later to get home prices to drop. And they weren't going to drop from that $16,000 mark. They were going to drop from the $200,000
Yeah. Okay. No, I agree with that. And I definitely want to second the comment that it only costs you more money by waiting on housing.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. So that being said, I mean, we've kind of answered this question a little bit, but let's take a fresh take on that. Why is housing or real estate a good investment still?
Two words: leveraged appreciation.
And all right, explain that.
Well, first of all, to own $400,000 worth of Amazon stock, you have to come pony up $400,000, and then you get your gain on that $400,000 or your loss. Okay, but to buy a $400,000 home, today's consumer can get into that for as little as $20,000, maybe as much as, you know, $40,000 or $80,000. But what you're doing is you're putting a small amount of money to control a large asset. And real estate has gone up 5.2% every year on average for the last 80 years. Okay, so when you leverage something 5 to 1, and it goes up 5%, that's 25% increase on your equity.
Oh, I love that.
Okay. And you, when you look at it as an investment, standalone investment, it makes a lot of sense. But when you look at it through the eyes of someone who needs a place to live, it's not like you're going to buy a house or live under the overpass. You're either going to buy a house or you're going to
live somewhere, right?
That's right.
Yeah, absolutely.
And if you look at the expenditure of renting compared to the leveraged equity growth that you get through buying, it's a no-brainer. I've actually got a video that just came out about 30 minutes ago is a home proper leverage for inflation. And it's all about leveraged appreciation.
Well, I love that you tied it back to the renting, because as soon as you mentioned that, I was going to go right to that, because I think that's one of the baffling things, especially with the younger generation, is that a lot of them are just like, well, houses are too expensive, I'm just going to rent. I was like, you can't afford to do that. Like, you're never going to get ahead that way. Houses build wealth.
And that's always been true. But what's happening today makes it even crazier. Year over year, rents are up 11%. But year over 2 year, it's up 23 to 24%. That means if I'm sitting there going, they're too expensive to buy, I'm going to wait till prices fall, in the last 2 years, your rent's gone up 24%.
Yeah. And you got nothing to show for it. You know, at least if you're putting,
you got a happy landlord,
you got principal that you're putting in, and you're, you know, the house is appreciating. So, you know, I kind of figured on a, like a $400,000 house that you're probably coming out about $14,000 ahead by owning a home, just with principal payments, and which is probably about $7,000, and then another $7,000 and, you know, appreciation of the property.
And something only a data nerd would bring up. We often compare.
That's why you're on here.
Yeah. We often compare like the median home price with the median rent. What most people don't understand, though, is the median rent doesn't get you the same place as the median home price. The median home being sold is a nicer place to live than the median rental unit. Because the rental side, you have tons of apartment units that are bringing in the median. And so when you go, well, the median rent is this and the median price is this, they're not for the same unit.
Absolutely.
You're probably looking at median plus 15% to compare to the median house that you can buy.
Sure. Good point. So let's talk a little bit about housing affordability, because that's a huge passion of mine as well. And it's definitely getting out of control. And what are your thoughts on it?
I would say that the next president will find that housing affordability is probably the biggest issue on the table, unless we get another pandemic or Russia decides to
pending world events, yes. a local economic thing would be, I think, should be, maybe it won't be, but should be on the top of the list.
It's going to have to be, because the homeless rate has been rising for the last 4 years and it had been declining for a long period of time. There are working class Americans priced out of renting and buying in most of the major large cities. So it's a problem that was born from NIMBYism, not in my backyard.
Yep.
It's perpetuated. It's funny because it's a national problem executed locally. You know, there's no New Yorkers that are causing problems in my market area, but the problems they're causing in their market area, I've got locals causing in my market area.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you're right, because I mean, just as a brief example in my world, I had a subdivision that I was creating next to an existing subdivision, and I was going to lower the square footage of the homes. They were by 100 square feet, a whole 100 square feet. And, you know, these are 2,100 square foot ranches in the one subdivision. Mine were going to be 2,000, right? Like, big deal. And the neighbors came out and they screamed and complained. And I did get my 100 square feet less. I should have went for a lot less than that. But my argument was, every single home that I build in the subdivision is going to cost $100,000 more than your most expensive home in your subdivision, because that's what they cost and that's what they're going to sell for. So I'm actually improving your values. And I, you know, you have to go through these exercises with the municipality. And I had actually bring in an appraiser, and he came in and basically said the exact same thing that I said. And then he pulled the data out and showed it. But those are a lot of challenges that every builder, every developer faces on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah, it's crazy. I was speaking to our local builders association last month, and right now our average new home is 2,100 square feet, or our median new home is 2,100 square feet. I told them they should be building 800 to 1,500 square foot units.
Yeah,
they need to meet the market where the market can afford to buy their homes.
Yeah. And so that's one of the things, like, the next question was basically, how do we fix housing affordability? And I agree with you on that. It's going to be about density and smaller homes. The challenge is that a lot of the municipalities, like, especially in my area, and you can jump in on this too. In my area, we have a mandatory, you know, minimum square footage in most of our areas of like 1,800 square feet.
Yeah.
And then we also have, oh, your lot has to have 20-foot side setbacks, 50-foot front setbacks, got to be X amount wide. And that automatically eliminates building those smaller homes.
Yeah, I think what you're going to find is the well-governed metropolitan areas are going to revoke a lot of their stupid rules. They're not going to come inside of an established neighborhood and change their setbacks. They're not going to change the housing size density. But what they're going to do is they're going to open up windows of infill opportunities. They're going to open up windows of new development opportunities. And they're going to go, hey, if you can build an 800 square foot house, which is basically a 2-bedroom, 2-bath, maybe attached unit, if you can build something like that, and there's a whole market of people that want that, you're doing this community a service by creating housing that's, I'll use the word affordable. It's not under the government's definition of affordable.
Absolutely.
But I just mean it's a whole lot less money than the bigger homes.
No, I agree with you 100%. And like, one example of this that I can share is like the city of Houston. So they've turned it on its head. And instead of having a minimum lot size, they have a maximum lot size. So you can have a 45-foot wide lot, 55 and a 65-foot wide lot. And that's it. And so that automatically pushes everything in and creates these boxes where you can create some smaller, hopefully more affordable product on the market.
Well, I'm not a expert in the management of, you know, housing and community rules and all that. But when I was looking at land use examples, because Florida's is poor, and when I was trying to look at, well, you know,
I think most of them are poor around the country, but that's just my opinion.
And I think you're right. But what I was going to do was compliment Texas, because they had the least impact from the housing bubble and the fastest recovery, because their builders and developers weren't planning for 3 and 4 years out, because you go out and you buy 3 parcels of land and then you get turned down on 2 of them and you can develop 1 of them. Okay. And so you have to do this years and years in advance to try to forecast against the future demand.
Super risky business, by the way.
Yeah. And in Texas, from what I'm reading and understanding, they just don't deal with that. And like, if you've got something that's zoned and you go, hey, I want to do this, and they go ahead and do it, because it's already zoned for that.
Yeah. Certainty in the development process is huge for a developer, because it is a huge financial risk. I mean, you think about this, you've got maybe potentially millions of dollars just going into the raw land, you have millions of dollars going into the development. Then you also have to, a lot of times, guarantee the money that you're going to put in case something happens to you. So now you've got to set up a second, you almost have to pay for the development twice. And then, you know, the market is changing monthly. So, you know, what is true now is not true 3 years from now or 2 years from now. So the more certainty you can get, but I think also the speed at which you develop the community also helps too. So if you can make it go True. Faster and you can be more certain up front, it would encourage more development, certainly. Do you agree with that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And what stands in the way is the fact that people that have no rights to a property can come and protest to your local municipality saying, hey, we don't want that built there. Well, why? Well, because we live here and it looks better as trees. Yeah, well, absolutely. You know, it's not your land. You don't have that. That opinion shouldn't be considered.
Yeah. And I love there are some people on the boards that have gotten smart. And the next question that gets fired out, if they're smart, is, was that property for sale? And usually the person coming up says, well, yeah. And it's like, you could have bought it, couldn't you?
Why that'll you block development. Then? Yeah. Block exactly. the development. Own everything.
Yep. Otherwise, exactly. If you want it to be the way it is, you certainly had the right to buy it and keep it that way.
Amen.
Yep. So I love that answer. We don't hear that quite often enough. So one last thing back to housing affordability. What do you think are some other fixes? We talked about like the density and, you know, that kind of thing. But what do you think are some other fixes for affordability?
Honestly, I think the biggest thing is education. I think if we did a better job getting people to understand why their life was so costly, they wouldn't hold developers' arms behind their backs. And, you know, I think a great example of what's wrong with housing can be seen in the auto industry. You look at the supply backlog and the you know supply chain disruption that occurred from COVID, and what we've seen is new car prices are through the roof, used car prices are through the roof. Do you think the federal government is going to do something to shut factories down from building cars? Because if it was housing, that's what they would do. Yeah. Okay, prices are soaring. Let's shut the builders down. Let's make it too expensive. Let's take away the mortgage product from the buyer. Let's shut down housing. We need to kill these house prices. But in the auto industry, though, they're going to go out and they're going to compete against each other and they're going to start producing too many cars. And right. soon you're going to see the largest dealers out there with too many cars and they're going to go, whoa, we got to slow production down.
Yeah.
So the market will correct the auto industry, but our federal government is going to take housing in its hand. And their fixes have not been working.
Correct. Well, and then the other issue is with the housing market, it's a lot more scattered than the auto industry, which is kind of concentrated into, let's say, six or so manufacturers, really big right. companies, right? With the housing industry, there's thousands and thousands of builders around the country, some big, some small. So you have that issue. But then, you know, I think the other challenge with the housing industry is that you have you already have a deficit in homes. We have 500,000 homes that we're probably short on right now today. And it's so hard to
Are
ramp.
Are you talking production. About in your market or do you mean US?
I just think in the US because
2.5 to 5 million short right now.
How much?
2.5 to 5 million short wow. in the US
okay,
right
I'm,
now.
I'm low on that number. Well, yeah. and one of the issues is that from the last recession, the housing bubble, we lost half our workforce. And you don't replace an entire half of a workforce, especially skilled trades, when you take it out of your schools. These guys got day jobs that left the industry. We still haven't replaced most of the people that left the industry. So we should be producing probably anywhere from 1.1 to 1.4 million homes a year. And yet we're barely hitting the 1 million mark. And we really can't increase it because we just don't have the labor force.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're looking at every year that you're 500,000 short in production is another 500,000 you need the next year. And we started our production shortages back in 2009. Yep. And see, that was a big misconception of the housing bubble. If you would have asked any layperson or any even real estate expert back in 2009, what happened to housing, they would have pointed at you. They would have said the builders overbuilt the market. The builders built so many homes that prices crashed. Hey, but if you take a step back and analyze it with the lens of time, you go, well, do you realize all those homes they built that didn't sell that went over to the rental market?
Yep.
Rents didn't drop.
Yep.
All those homes that were produced went to the rental market and rents didn't drop. That means the demand for those homes was there. So it wasn't the supply side of the market that collapsed. It was the demand side.
Yeah,
and what happened on the demand side? They rewrote the rules on how to get a mortgage.
Yep. Well, that's exactly it, is the finance policy. And, you know, obviously, you know, what got them into trouble is you got people doing, you know, 120% loans or things like that.
And well, but that got a lot of blame. Okay. Yep. And that was such a tiny part of what happened. But what really happened was they took away the loan from someone who had damaged credit, not not bad credit, because they had some of those loans out there and they got all the press. But someone with a 640 credit score who can buy a home today, who has been doing really well in today's market, they couldn't get a house in 2007.
Yep, that makes sense.
And that is where we incorrectly blame the builders for building too many homes. And in reality, we just took away the builders' buyers.
Yep, that makes sense. Yeah, I agree with that. And then the other thing that I want to share with you, and maybe you've heard this number, and just get your opinion on it. So National Association of Home Builders every 5 years does a study on the cost of regulation and how it affects the cost of new homes. And they just recently updated their number, and I might be off by a few dollars, but the cost of local, state, and federal regulation added to the cost of a new home right now is $93,000, $300, and I think it's like $8. I could be off by a few bucks, but that is just an insane number. What do you think about that?
I bet you that's, and I don't know this number, but I bet you that's very close to the median lot price too.
Meaning? Depends on the market. Yeah, like my median lot price right now is $160,000.
Right, but I'm going across the U.S.
That, oh, sure. You know, yeah.
And what that basically says is, your median builder in America is out $200,000 before they even bring the first piece of lumber to the site.
Yeah, you're correct.
That's yeah, very correct. That's it's hard to produce $220,000 homes when that is your reality.
Yeah.
When you're $200,000 out before going vertical.
Yeah, I can't build it for zero, right?
Right.
No, I think that's a huge point. And you know, I just look at it and I tell people, you know, if the house would have cost $300,000, now it costs $400,000 basically. And that, you know, that takes out, you know, thousands and thousands of home buyers in every state when you have that.
Some of that I'm not so sure there's a cure for. And what I'm seeing in our local area, we call them impact fees. And impact fees is where if you're putting in a subdivision, a neighborhood, whatever you want to call it, you've got to pay for how you're going to impact the roads and the utility usage. Absolutely. In the area.
We have the exact same thing, Joe. So we know that very well.
Okay. Well, the impact fees, when the government did a poor job planning for 20 years and there's only one chunk of land left on the road, and they go, well, the only way to recover our situation in this part of the city is we need to hit the developer with impact fees. Like, well, how much is those impact fees? Oh, about $300,000 a lot. Yeah, but I'm trying to build $250,000 houses. You make it up in volume, I guess.
Yeah, and no, you're right. I mean, it's like penalizing somebody new for the mistakes of the past. And that's it's just not right. And we have an issue in our area that there's some rules in place about impact fees and none of the municipalities follow them, their own rules. And so like, for example, they're supposed to actually create a report and show how the money is going to be used. And then if the money is not used within 7 years, they're supposed to refund it to the developer. Well, we had like 30 developers in a room and we asked a simple question: who here in this room has ever gotten money back from impact fees? And raise your hand. And there was no hands that went up. And this has been going on for 20 plus years. Certainly there should have been some people that got money back. So, you know, obviously holding our government accountable is another thing, but you know, the regulatory cost is a big chunk that can be changed and reduced. And, you know, obviously the density is a big thing. I think the regulation is another big thing. Lumber is going to cost what it's going to cost. You know, land is still going to have a fairly fixed.
Let me address lumber prices.
Sure.
And I am on this podcast, I am the least educated on lumber prices.
That's okay. I'll fill in the gaps.
Okay. But by my last count, there are 13 states in the U.S. that have, by voter mandate, changed minimum wage to go to $15 an hour. Okay. And so what that has meant in Florida is we've seen the minimum wage up 40% over the last 3 years, and it's going to go up another 36% over the next 2 years.
Wow.
And it's my belief that politicians make these movements to pander to the poor. The trouble is it never helps the poor in the long run, because what we're going to see is increased wages at every level. So we're going to be facing wage inflation for the next 10, 15 years to overcome this artificial growth at the bottom end. And what that means is the cost of lumber has to go up, because the people that are preparing those trees into lumber and the people that are transporting that lumber to Absolutely. Your site, on top of all your contractors that are out there, on top of every other material that was delivered to your site, they have to go up. And we're talking about in these key states, basically 76 to 80% growth in the minimum wage. So we're going to end up in a with a country where the federal minimum wage law might be at $9 an hour, but all these other states are at 15. You're just going to see everybody cave to that. There are too many corporations that are not going to go, well, I'm going to pay someone in Mississippi $8.80 an hour, but next door in Alabama, I'm going to pay them $15 an hour.
Yeah, well, I can tell you what will happen, right? If you live in one of the lower wage states and you're nearby, you're just going to cross the border, right?
That's it. And so we are guaranteed wage inflation. And what I'm concerned with is what that's going to mean is fewer people working for more money. So yep. You're going to see a lot of the lower end of the pay scale lose their jobs because companies can't afford to pay them.
Absolutely. And then you have the people that are, let's say the minimum wage was 10. We'll just use simple examples, right? The minimum wage was 10. They move it to 15. Well, your people that are making $20 an hour are going, well, that guy's making 15. I'm worth at least 10 more dollars than him. So then they want the same commensurate level of increase.
Trickle up economics. It's got to go that way. You're going to see all, and we're already seeing it. I mean, as a small business owner, I used to be able to, our median household income in Tallahassee is just under $60,000. So if I held open a $40,000 a year job, I would have 80 applicants. When I do a $40,000 a year job promotion now, the only applicants I get are fresh out of college or 21 years old.
Yeah. And they're going to want to be at 50 or 60,000 a year or two.
Yeah. And so Wage inflation's real. It is one of the side benefits in housing is that we're going to see the relative affordability of homes come down if home price growth decreases, because I believe wage inflation's here to stay. What's scary is the Fed is fighting inflation, but it cannot fight wage inflation because it's voter mandated.
Yep.
And so a major piece of the inflation measurement that the Fed is combating is working against the Fed. So I think long interest rates might be up for a long time.
Okay. So what about just your outlook in general for the housing market in the next year or two? What are your thoughts there on that?
I would say that, first of all, it's local. So whatever I say, don't apply it to your market. Correct. Learn your market a little bit. Learn the supply and demand in your area. I know that as a general rule, we're grossly undersupplied by homes. I think you have some metropolitan areas that are shrinking and they're going to have supply issues, too much supply. You've got metropolitan areas that are growing. They're going to have supply issues, not enough supply. So the key is to know the local economics of where you're at, because supply and demand is going to dictate the changes in home prices. And I can tell you, I don't see any real estate agents measuring supply and demand. I look across the country. I never see supply and demand reports. It never means maybe there's 10 of us out there doing it, you know, across the country. And, you know, if I'm a builder, I'm like, I want to know these numbers, because you said it's so hard to bring a development to the market. And like I told you, our local homes are the new constructions at 2,100 square feet. Well, they were planning these developments back when the government was handing out stimulus money and interest rates were at 2.25%. So 2,100 square foot homes made a lot of sense when they were planning it.
Yeah.
You know, and now here we are.
No, it's a good example. I guess I equate this to some other discussions I have in the industry in general. And I kind of say, they've said this on other industries, but like housing is the same, where it's like turning around the Titanic, right? Like once you send the ship out in a certain direction, you can't just turn the wheel and it spins all the way around. If you started a development 2 years ago and you just keep getting in the market, you know, you can't just all of a sudden go back to the municipality and say, oh, you know what, we're going to change everything we just planned and start over. And we're going to do it tomorrow.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And what people don't understand is they are the reason we have this problem. It's you, it's me, look in the mirror. That's where the problem in housing is. And that's why you said, what can we do to fix home affordability? It really starts with education. Because if you continue to be the problem, a politician is going to respond to you and not Correct. Fix the problem.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'll leave you with one thing. So I do this talk for free a lot of times in my area, and I've been asked to give it a lot of times, and it's like the 11 challenges to housing affordability. But one of the things that I point out in my market is that I look back at the 1950s, because that was like, I think, an ideal time for the housing market and people's lives in general, because you basically what I determined is I looked at the average state income and then the average cost of a new home. And back in the 1950s, at least in Wisconsin, it was double someone's income. So for twice your income, you could buy a home. So only one person had to work. That person had the ability to go out and buy, you know, all the new appliances, the TV, the new car, and they were still whole. Nowadays, it's like 8.5 times the average income, in, at least in Wisconsin, to buy a new home. So now you're seeing the husband working, the wife working, one of them's got a side hustle, and they're still falling further and further behind. And that is one of the biggest issues I think we face as a country is...
I'll give you a scarier continuation of that story.
Okay, I love it.
It's my belief, and I would love for anybody to prove me wrong on this, but it's my belief that we're going to start seeing a rapid centralization of housing. And what that means is take a look at Bezos and what he's done with Amazon. He thought he was going to sell books online, but he discovered, hey, I can sell everything online. And what he's done is he's sucked mom and pop operations out of all the local markets and replace them with an online delivery process. Well, what we're seeing now is investment banks are starting to buy single family homes, and they currently own 0.2% of all homes in America. So they are by no means a major player, and in no state do they own 1% of the rental properties.
Okay. That makes sense.
But it's my belief that home ownership, which started accelerating after World War II and has reached as high as 68% recently, I think we're going to go back to sub 50% levels.
Wow.
I think we're going to see a Amazon of housing establish itself. It's going to buy up all the houses. And instead of you spending a third of your income to live in a house that you own, you're going to spend half of your income to rent it from a mega giant from Wall Street.
Wow.
And if you want a good parallel to this, just look at student housing in the U.S. 25 years ago, 99% of student housing was owned locally. Today, I think Wall Street owns most of the student housing complexes that you'll see around the major universities.
Wow, that's interesting. No, very interesting take. And I think, you know, just with the rates being low, I think, you know, obviously we've seen a big influx in, you know, the build to rent market and, you know, investors buying. And what's scary as well is seeing, you know, foreign entities coming into the country and buying up a lot of our property. And, you know, the problem is you get to that tipping point, right, where they own too much of it and they can dictate whatever they want for the rates. It's still a free market, but then, right, you know, all of a sudden they tip those things up. And
but imagine when it's one entity controlling 20% of the homes in your area.
Yeah, well,
what if there's one decision maker controlling 20%? Because I bet you if you did a study 20 years ago, there was nobody in a major metropolitan area that owned 1% of the housing units.
Correct.
Now imagine there's a decision maker that controls 20, 30, 40% of the housing units. That means they can single-handedly go, rents are up 10%. Do it across the board. What are you going to do? Are you going to move to a house that's not available? You're going to move under an overpass? You're going to move into a cardboard box? Because if you want to rent, they're up 100, you know, they're up 10%.
Yeah. The only thing is what people are doing now, which is they're cohabitating and getting creative, but you know, who wants to live like that permanently for the rest of their lives with, you know, a house packed full of people.
Well, if we stop people like you from building homes, cohabitation needs to become on everybody's monitor as what they're looking forward to.
Amen. Yeah, absolutely. Well, this has been a good discussion. Is there something that maybe I didn't touch on that you'd like to share or add to the conversation?
No, I would like to readdress something because we got off on a tangent, is recency bias. And I will tell you that recency bias is simply the habit of people to give more credence to something that has happened more recently than something that happened in the past. And I will tell you, the majority of stuff I read about real estate is a headline with a couple blanks in it that says, the reason the housing market is going to crash is blank. Because everybody expects the housing market to crash. Now, I expect it to crash, even though my data tells me it's not going to. Okay, because home prices jumped up 30% in 2 years. You can't afford that. Homes are not affordable. Right. But instead of letting go of that emotion and going, okay, let's figure out how it's going to crash, people are just going, well, no one can afford these prices, you're going to see all these foreclosures. I'm like, well, what about all the equity in the market? Won't right. people just buy those homes, and the people who fell behind on their payments, won't they just get a pile of money and go rent? You know, so there's so much speculation, but I think it's all built upon recency bias. Everybody expects the housing market to crash because that's what it did 15 years ago. But the previous crash was World War II. The previous crash before that was the Great Depression. That's it. Three crashes, yeah, 100 years.
You're 100% right. And I think that's one of the challenges. You know, people hear something enough times, whether it's true or not, they start to believe it. And it, when you start to look at the data and you go, no, that there's just not really a physical way for that to happen. But the problem is, you know, we only have a certain size megaphone, right? And the media has a bigger megaphone. So if the media chooses to use their megaphone on one particular thing and it's not correct, you know, that's the challenge that we face. The only thing we can do is continue to support each other as industry professionals and content creators and get our information out and hopefully, you know, prove our trustworthiness and get that the correct information out and hopefully, you know, do our part to control the narrative as best we can.
Amen. Absolutely. Get the word out.
Yep, absolutely. So if people want to get more information about you or find your videos, where can they go?
My videos are on YouTube, where our YouTube channel, our new handle is just Manasa, M-A-N-A-U-S-A. So if you go look for Joe Manasa Real Estate on YouTube, you'll find us. I also write a daily blog. It's much more local in nature. My YouTube channel is more U.S. housing market based. Every Monday morning I put out a pretty analytical article for people who prefer to take it in through their eyes instead of their ears. Yes.
Perfect. Well, I'll add the link for your YouTube channel because it's excellent. I would definitely recommend anyone check it out. I'll put the link in the show notes. So if you're on the road and you want to listen to it, you can check it out there. And then just a huge thank you again to Joe for joining the Home Building Hero today. Great conversation. I appreciate everything that you're doing out there and keep it up.
Thanks, David. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Once again, thank you for tuning in to the Home Building Hero, broadcasting live from the Bellman Home Studio. If you haven't already, please make sure to give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts and make sure to hit that subscribe button so you don't miss any future content. Until next time, I'm David Bellman, signing off.